Good morning. This is the Peace and Justice Program. My name is Chris. The Peace and Justice Program is brought to you on KZFR Community Radio every Friday from 11:30 to 1 with different hosts. That was a West African dance troupe called Sinte. And I have on the line with me Jean Christofferson, who I'd like to introduce before she talks to us about dance and culture. Jean Christofferson was raised in a socialist Quaker activist family in Montana in the 1950s. Her father was a conscientious objector during World War II when his alternative service was as a smoke jumper fighting forest fires. Her mother was born in India, spoke four languages, and advocated for children and against the death penalty. One grandfather had the first integrated church in the 1930s in Staten Island, and the other taught in a black high school in Cleveland, Ohio. Her Aunt Nancy, an unwed mother in the 40s, raised a daughter with a black father in Spanish Harlem in New York City. Currently, Jean Christofferson's family includes people of African American, Japanese, and Native American ancestry. Jean has a BFA in drama and dance, a master's in performance culture and education. She's taught yoga and cultural dance at Chico State for more than 18 years, as well as maintaining a community dance performance group, and she's had many lifelong relationships with expatriate artists from West Africa, the Congo, Haiti, Cuba, and Brazil. She's brought countless people to Chico, facilitating workshops and performances, and most recently 35 drummers and dancers at the Chico Women's Club to dance and play for Djemba Sako, a master dancer from Mali. Welcome to the Peace and Justice program. Jean, I'm so glad to have you here with me today. Happy Women's History Month, and I know you wanted I know you wanted to start out talking about women's history in modern dance, something called Dress Reform Mothers. I don't even know what that is, but please tell us about your unique experience.
Thanks for listening. Dance is not a verbal art, and so it goes. People don't know a lot about the history of it. People know what some of it looks like. It also exists in the moment, and so it's ephemeral and comes and goes. You know, and the history of dance is held in the bodies of the people who execute it, right? Even more than the people who watch it. And in my travels through the world of dance and the language of dance and the cultures of dance, I have found out some things by doing it that I would not have known if I just watched it. So one of the most fascinating things about dance in the United States for me is that the two women that were responsible for popularizing it and opening up American culture to dance as an art form and not just as an entertainment form, and they were up against, so this happened in the late 1800s. These two women, ironically, were born the same year. They were born in 1878, which is also, I believe, the year of Queen Victoria's Jubilee, because it was my grandmother's birthday as well. But anyways, Isadora Duncan, you've probably heard that name. She was born in San Francisco. Her mother was a musician, a pianist, and a seamstress. The father was not around, and she supported herself in the arts, but she was also part of a movement that was called the Dress Reform Movement. So this means she did not wear a corset in the late 1800s. This was absolutely something women had to do if they were polite, right? So she raised a daughter without the constriction of a corset, which allowed her freedom of movement. And I'm not sure if she rode a bicycle or not, but that was something women just didn't do. I seem to remember she rode a bicycle. And this is also true of Ruth St. Denis, who was on the opposite coast, being raised in an utopian community by another dress reform mother in a basically counterculture community. And these existed, you know, and they have existed in history. There have always been these people in their little communities doing it the way they saw it and stepping outside of social convention. So both these girls were raised with freedom of movement at a time when women were very constricted, both in their roles and physically, by wearing corsets all the time. So I'll stick with Isadora for a moment. Both women were very beautiful. They were gorgeous young women, and they moved beautifully. This was something that they just had naturally, partly because it hadn't been stamped out of them. And their families were indigent, and so they they quickly capitalized on their daughter's beauty. And Isadora, her brother, was also an artist, and she began dancing barefoot, which was considered obscene at the time. And she started studying the dancers in Greek art, in ancient Greek art, on pottery and in frescoes and stuff, and looking at their clothing, and she copied the clothing, and she copied the shapes of the bodies, and she was able to extrapolate for her own satisfaction what the dance would have looked like. So she went to the past, to a culture that she didn't know personally, but she could fantasize, or she could, it's kind of like it was in code, and she could read the code. And so she began dancing in parlors for rich women for their teas and things like that. And she started bringing in money that way. Now, over on the other coast, the St. Denis's family was also hard up for money. And her mother, when she was a teenager, took her down to vaudeville in New York City. And she could do cartwheels, which was unheard of for a girl at that time. And she became a novelty performer in vaudeville. And pretty soon, she caught the eye of David Belasco, who was doing these big kind of, kind of parade-y. He was doing productions with young women dressed up in beautiful costumes to music. Not really dancing, but, you know, walking across the stage in beautiful clothes and backing up other people that were doing things on stage. So they both were launched into theater. And Isadora eventually, and they were working with classical music primarily. They were working, of course, with live music, and they found people to accompany them. Isadora loved Chopin a lot. She danced a lot of Chopin. But Isadora ended up, she got a European tour, and she ended up performing all over Europe. I can't be more specific than that. So this is the early 1900s we're talking about. So she was in her early 20s at the time. And she ended up staying in Europe because they really liked her there. And she was against marriage. She had several children with lovers out of wedlock. She was a very flamboyant personality. And among other things, the people from the Russian ballet saw her dance, and it changed the entire trajectory of their ballet companies in Russia, because they saw her step, break the mold and step out of the mold. Now, Ruth St. Denis, what happened to her was, in 1893, there was a World Parliament of Religion in Chicago, and they invited Vivekananda, who was an Indian yogi. And he came and performed asanas in Chicago. And you can imagine, he was wearing a loincloth in a time when everybody was dressed to the hilt, you know, and nobody looked at anybody's skin. But he attracted so much attention that he was able to open a yoga center in New York City in the 1890s. Get this. You know, we didn't start all this. It's been going on for a long time. So somehow, in her travels, Ruth St. Denis found Vivekananda. And she eventually, I'm not going to go through all the stages of her career and everything, but eventually she ended up in California. She ended up in Hollywood. And at that point, she had a partner, a man who was a little bit younger than she was. And they started a school called the Denishawn School. And she would begin her classes, her dance classes, dressed in a sari, sitting in a full lotus. Then a young woman named Martha Graham came through her school, and that's a name that if you study dance at all, you know Martha Graham. So she studied a yoga-based dance technique with Ruth St. Denis. And then she went off to New York in the 1920s and began working on the floor, which nobody had done before. She began working on the floor, and I believe that was connected to her experience with yoga. And she developed a technique called Graham Technique. Now, I studied Graham Technique when I was in college. She started a whole company, and she had this very specific technique that she thought that involved a lot of sitting on the floor. And in 1974, I went to a workshop and realized that I took Iyengar yoga and dance at the same time and realized that they interfaced each other, that there was a progression through the dance work that I was doing that followed the progression of Iyengar yoga, which I think is absolutely fascinating. But I digress, and what I want to go back to was dance in America.
Okay, let me stop you there. I wanted to reintroduce you. This is Jean Christofferson, a legendary Chico dance performance artist and teacher, and we're here at KZFR. And I do want to ask you about, you talked about these unconventional and embodied people as really like being torches for, you know, the evolution of not only dance, but culture in America. So we just have like 12 minutes more, and I want to have you be able to get all the material in that you wanted to cover. Go ahead.
Okay. So the United States was founded, you know, it was the dominant force in this country for a long time was the Northeast, was the Puritans. And they were anti-body and anti-dance. And one of the connections I would like to make in this 12 minutes is that the attitude that Europe has towards the body has a lot to do with their attitudes towards indigenous and what I call primary or earth-based cultures. And everywhere that Europeans went, all over the world, they suppressed the expression of the body. And that is something that people don't put a finger on, but when you come down to it, the first thing they did when they went into cultures in Africa, in the Philippines, in Hawaii, in Australia, wherever they went, in India, they tried to stop people from dancing. And I've grown up in this culture, and I found a book in the university library that's called Adversaries of Dance, From Puritans to the Present. And this was a very active movement. You know, it was considered unchristian. It was considered that it was, no matter what you did with your body, it would be sexual and it would lead to immoral behavior. And especially any woman who danced in public would be, you know, a fallen woman and end up on the streets. And I mean, it's appalling to read these tracts, but the truth is that they continue. And dance is an art form, or dance is a recreation form. I have struggled my whole life to make a living as a dancer because our culture doesn't support it. Now, if I go to Brazil, people dance in the streets. If I go to Cuba, they dance in the streets. If I go to Puerto Rico on Sunday afternoon, everybody's out at these picnic shelters dancing salsa. And it just makes me lonely when I come into many situations, even where there is music and a dance floor, where people don't engage. But it's really clear to me that our lack of appreciation and our lack of ability to do what I call read the body is part of our lack of appreciation for African-based, Mexican-based, you know, Balinese dance, all these kinds of things. We consider them extra and peripheral, and we do not include them in our education systems. We do not fund them in our communities. And even if we're funding I don't know. You know, the Chico Creek dance company used to get $40,000 from the city. They've gotten grants of $40,000 from the city. But that has never been the case for any kind of a culturally, I'm going to call it culturally based dance, whether it's Hmong or, you know. So I taught for 18 years at the university, and a large part of that I taught a cultural dance class. And it is just amazing what is in, just in this community. You know, there's hula and there's flamenco and there's all these amazing, amazing dance forms. And they are done in people's living rooms. They are done tucked away in little corners. And they just don't have much public support, you know. People like seeing everybody dressed up in costumes and out at a festival day, but people don't realize what it takes, you know, which is space. And I was just on an arts panel for the California, you know, California's going to spend $80 million on dance. No, 60, I can't remember.
That's
millions
good.
Of dollars
That's
is in
great.
The budget.
Yeah.
And the panel was mainly about visual arts, and I kept saying, music and dance, ethnic music and dance. I said, we're just looking for a room to dance in, and that's what's going on right now. Is I'm part of a group that does capoeira, and they're trying to just get a room to dance in. And it's expensive because dancers need a lot of space, and they don't make a lot of money. So anybody who's got a nice big space with a dance floor, you want to hear about it. So you want me to talk about what I'm up to now? Are we up to that? Or are we done?
No, I think it would be great if you tell us about what you're doing and, you know, promote the work that this embodied experience. I am really hearing what you have to say about both how dance pollinates cultures, but also about how repressed it is and how, you know, I believe that the lack of cultural understanding among people probably is one of the causes of war. So please keep going.
Okay. So so there's a lot of dance going on in Chico. Right now I'm teaching mainly children. I do a class called Unplugged Arts, and it's mainly, children love to move. And again, we're in a culture that says, sit still, sit in the desk, don't run. Girls, how many times have I heard people say, girls don't run, boys don't cry, you know? And I am just, I get so much joy from the, just watching children respond to music, watching children just revel in their body's ability to move. So that's what I work with. I work with imagination and movement. And I teach right now at Chico Women's Club, and I have a couple of after-school classes for different ages. And I do a camp in June up in Cohasset and Shandon Ridge. It's a sleepover camp for 6 days where kids between the ages of 8 and 12 come, and we dance and play music and swim and tell stories and make a show. And it's interesting because the show is always about saving the world. It's quite fascinating. The kids come up with the show, and it's always about saving the world. Fascinating. I also am supporting, you know, the ethnic teachers in town. Right now, it's amazing. There's a capoeira group that meets Tuesday nights at the Women's Club. There's a Congolese man who's teaching on Saturdays in Dorothy Johnson Park. There's a woman teaching samba at 2 o'clock on Sundays in Dorothy Johnson Park. And a woman named Imelda Mata, who went to Mexico. She was one of my students at Butte College. She went off to Mexico and found a bunch of Mexicans who were totally dialed into African dance. And she went to Africa with this group. So it's, you know, there's people in Japan doing African dance. There's people in Australia because it's such an evolved and advanced form of dance. And everybody loves to do it. When I was living in New York City, I was in a company with Jewish, Sweden, Iranian, and Haitian and African American and Anglo and people. It's amazing where who comes together to dance. You know, people really don't care what size you are, what shape you are in the world of ethnic dance, which is not true in theatrical dance, where a lot of people aren't the right size or shape, and they feel they can't continue. I also, Monday nights at 5:30 at Chico Women's Club, a woman named Olivia James, who's she teaches West African, and then every other month, David Durocier, who's from Haiti, is teaching also. The month of April, he's going to be teaching at the Women's Club at 5:30. These are all classes that are open to the community, live drumming for almost all of them. And if you're interested in the music, people are really happy to teach. A lot of it involves singing as well. And we'll be bringing more gift artists in, native artists.
That's wonderful. You know, Jean, one of the questions I have for you is I was at the library one day and I saw a poster on the wall. It was you, and you were trying to start a political theater group, and I just wanted to ask you about that before we have to end.
Yeah. So I'm putting a call out for people that would like to express their political views artistically. And this involves music, theater, dance, words. And I feel that I've done this before. I want to develop performances that clarify issues, that involve solutions, you know, where they're basically think tanks, and create performances that motivate people to take action. I haven't had much luck finding people that want to do that. I've had a few nibbles at the bait, but I haven't really, you know, I put this out 3 or 4 months ago, and I haven't really had much response.
How do people get hold of you if they're interested?
My phone is 530-345-6324. 530-345-6324. And I just want to say I'm a person that talks and does. I'm not a great online person. I'm not interested in really online presence so much. And I want experiences with my body that include my body and don't. You know, I wrote a thesis called Afrobilly and the Search for Meaning. And at the time, it was published in 2000. And this is before the phones and the internet had, cannibalized our attention. And I talk about computers a little bit, but mainly I talk about too much television. Well, that's nothing compared to what's going on now, where I get in the hot tub at the sports club and everybody's on their phone and they go in the sauna and people are on their phone. It's amazing they can't lapse with them, but, you know. And so I feel like one of my jobs is to hold space for the body. Embodied knowledge, embodied experience, especially for children, because we don't need all this screen as much as we use it. It can be useful, but it's taken us over. It's really alarming.
Yeah, I think we have to leave it there, but I think it's an important point for people to ponder as they go forward. And this recording will be in the KZFR archives for the list of different classes that are coming up that you mentioned. But is there a central clearinghouse for people so they can learn about classes that are ongoing or coming up?
I have a Facebook page called Afro-Caribbean Dance Club.
Okay.
And if anybody wants to join Afro-Caribbean Dance Club, I will be posting everything on there that's going on.
All right.
Yeah, you just okay?
Yeah, I'm writing myself a note about that. Thank you so much for being our guest today on the Peace and Justice program, and thank you for your life work. You are a jewel. We appreciate you very much.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
And Chris, thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, we are on the Peace and Justice program right now. I would like to thank underwriters now in preparation for our next guest, and I appreciate all the people in our community who are each doing their own thing, but I'm so grateful to Jean Christofferson for her work and all the times she has volunteered people in her dance troupe to dance it for nonprofits and gotten us all up and moving. And it's just, you know, something we just should never forget is our bodies. So I'd like to thank first Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. Also, want to thank Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. I'd also like to thank the Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit chicobk.com or at 530-892-8916. So we're not quite at the top of the hour, so I think I'll make an announcement before we go to our next guest. Hang on one second here. I've got a bunch of announcements, but we're going to be talking about the militarization of Chico Police Department. And so I think it's important to let you know that tonight is the last night at for a prisoner art show that Benny Gutierrez and the Greenhouse Studio is putting on at the 1078 Gallery, which is located at 1710 Park Avenue. This will be from 6 to 8 p.m. You will need a mask to get in. He brings up issues of mass incarceration always with these art projects and discussing the system that the art is coming out of. So really important work that Benny Gutierrez and the Greenhouse Studio folks are doing. So tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. for the closing of this exhibit. Also, KZFR is going to be sponsoring a broadcast of Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech at 4:30 to 5:30 on April 4th. And we'll have more about that in upcoming, but I just wanted you to know about it. So it's really something to look forward to. It's in collaboration with the Poor People's Campaign. So it is now the top of the hour. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, and volunteers. I'm going to put on a song to do the segue, and this is Linda Ellen's Singing the News, celebrating 50 years of Singing the News. She is, and the song, Bent Over Woman, we can still dance no matter how stove up we are. I have found that to be true myself. So here you go. Happy Women's Month, Women's History Month.
A woman, rise and lay your burdens down. Bent over woman, dignity will be your crown. Bent over woman, rise and lay your burden down. Bent over woman,
Dignity will be your crown. Bent over, woman, rise and lay your burden down. Bent over, woman, dignity will be your crown.
Bent down by poverty and bent down by shame. Bent down by preachers who never knew your name. Bent down by families who never knew your worth. Bent down by prejudice and bent down at your birth.
Bent over, woman, rise and lay your burden down. Bent over, woman, dignity will be your crown. Bent over, woman, rise and lay your burden down. Bent over, woman, dignity will be your crown.
Your dignity and stand for your work. Stand up for the children and stand for the poor. Stand up for your freedom and let your voices roar.
All right, our voices do need to roar. We have things coming up that are extremely important to our community, and I have on the line with me Margaret Zwick. She is a founding member of Concerned Citizens for Justice here in Chico, and I wanted to just introduce something to you really quickly so that kind of lay the groundwork for the conversation we're about to have. So in 90 and 91, the Department of Defense, under the National Defense Authorization Act, started transferring excess Department of Defense property to federal, state, and local law enforcement. And so this has been going on for like 30 years. This became termed the 1033 program. There were some modifications in the program made by President Obama, then reversed by the Trump administration. The Biden administration really hasn't done anything with this program, but it does funnel military hardware into communities. Governors of states appoint state coordinators to approve and certify law enforcement agencies in their states. Then law enforcement can then review online inventory of military surplus and make requests. Law enforcement agencies do not pay for the property, but they pay for the shipping of these as-is military supplies, and they're responsible for all costs associated with acquisition, maintenance, repairs, and cost to return any of the so-called controlled property when it's no longer needed. Cities have to have relevant public protocols for the use of the property, the supervision, training, and evaluation of use, including audits and accountability, which brings us to Chico Police Department Policy 709. Margaret Zwick, thanks for being my guest today. Can you bring us up to date on what is known about this Policy 709?
Hi, Chris. I hope I can. I will try. Policy 709 of the Chico Police Department manual is all about the rules and regulations to acquire military equipment. It was written by the for-profit criminal justice business Lexipol that has written all of our police policy. They write policy for many police and law enforcement agencies in California and around the country. Our policy is only, this 709 is only about 3.5 pages, but it defines military equipment. It establishes a military equipment coordinator, and it is clearly written with a different tone than is actually present in Assembly Bill 481, which authorized it. The purpose of AB 481 was to increase transparency, accountability, and oversight over the acquisition and use of military equipment. It requires that each law enforcement agency, including the sheriff, the district attorney, or a school district if they take military equipment, to seek the approval of elected officials, the city council, the board of supervisors, before purchasing or raising funds for military equipment.
And that went into effect in January, is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
And some of the dates jump out of my mind, but I think so.
Okay. So it's a relatively new requirement, and cities all over California, at least I know, are preparing their response to it. But in the meantime, I'd like to know, In Policy 709, the city, the police department, names some of the military equipment they are, it includes but is not limited to, and I would like you to tell us about what they wish to procure and your concerns about those specific weapons or devices.
Okay. Actually, what they have done at this point is just shared with us military equipment they possess. Policy 709 is and must be posted on the police website, so we all have access to that information, so everybody in the public can go to the website and see it. Chico police report that they have 7 drones that can be used for anything from crowd control, think a protest, to criminal investigations. The reasons they give themselves to be able to use drones is long, and it's just lengthy. They have a $200,000 Lenko Bearcat armored vehicle. Apparently, it's their second Bearcat. They have specialized firearms, too lengthy to describe here. They have distraction devices. They have numerous chemical agents, smoke canisters. They have lots of different pepper ball items. They have long-range acoustic devices for crowd and riot control. I hope that everybody will go to the police website and read it in detail.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying to me. It's terrifying, actually. If I were a supporter, I would say, well, this program provides an efficient way for local police to obtain equipment. So how would you respond to that, Margaret Zwick?
I would say, where is the demonstrated need? I have a few questions about that. Why does the police department need military equipment? That has not been established. What kind of problem are they trying to solve? What is a threat? How often has this occurred? How has military equipment solved the problem in Chico in the past? Under what conditions do they intend to use military equipment against residents? We do not want armored tanks, military weapons on our streets. They don't make us safer. All evidence is to the contrary. Militarizing our police creates aggressive policing, and we have seen that with the shooting to death of Desmond Phillips, Tyler Rushing, and Stephen Vest. Apparently, Chico police think weapons and military equipment are the first tools they should use in difficult situations. Well, we don't agree, because the evidence shows that the police who have military equipment are the most likely to have violent encounters with the public.
Yeah. So I'd like to get back to AB 481. This is a bill that was passed because of the militarization of police and the way that police use of violence has killed many unarmed people. And AB 481 seeks to provide transparency, oversight, and an opportunity for meaningful public input on decisions regarding whether and how military equipment is funded, acquired, or used. Now, on the 15th of March, the City Chico Agenda Report mentioned public engagement sort of in passing, but they have an ordinance which the city passed, although it goes to second and third readings. And it did mention 481 and what the requirements were within the ordinance. But what are your thoughts about this city council and what they're trying to do, or what they seem to want to do in terms of just moving this through? And what do you expect to happen at the upcoming council meeting?
Well, the way I understand it, the city council has already voted to approve this policy of military equipment for our Chico Police Department. I think, to date, it's a complete and absolute failure of transparency, a failure of oversight, and a failure of meaningful public input. Instead, what happened is this was posted on the police website, and we're not sure when, and placed on the city council agenda. In no way does that qualify as holding up public hearing. The bill required a well-publicized and conveniently located community engagement meeting. That didn't happen. The public was supposed to have time to discuss, to ask questions about the military equipment, about its funding, its acquisition, and its use. We didn't get to do that. And I want to point out that our elected officials do not have to accept any part of this policy. They can have a new and innovative policy, a humane and kind policy. They can have more stringent requirements on our police department or completely disavow the militarizing of our police. They can do that if you want to stand for a safe Chico, if they want to stand for a safe Chico.
Yeah. Yeah. Feels like they're really going in the wrong direction here. And another concern I and others have, of course, is that the Chico Police Department budget is already 49% of the Chico budget. And I wanted maybe you to talk about the concerns of the cost of this militarization. I mentioned earlier about this property has to be cared for and maintained, repaired. There has to be supervision, training, audits. I mean, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, that has to be shipped in, shipped out. What are your concerns about the cost of this militarization, just on the face of it, not even, you know, the lawsuits for unlawful deaths or, you know, the other stuff that might be coming down the road at us?
Well, you know, this is just one aspect of our Chico budget. What I'd like to say about the budget is that I've been working with CC4J since Concerned Citizens for Justice since day one, which was a few days after Desmond Phillips was murdered. I have no greater understanding today, Chris, of the police budget than I did years ago. The police budget is opaque. I don't know anyone who would say that they can see the big picture of what our police department is costing us. On the military equipment, they do list a dollar amounts on each weapon or military item at the website, but they do not list the cost, as you say, of training, of the cost of maintenance, or the cost of storage. We do not know what this department has paid out for use of force incidents or settlements. Actually, what we need is an accountant or two to help us understand the police budget and to help us develop a clear vision of what the taxpayers are spending on our police department. What we do know is that Chico has enormous needs for improved infrastructure and to resolve the humanitarian crises of homelessness on our streets. That need, we know, is going unmet while our police department is thriving.
Yeah, is that something that we should be rallying around, as some sort of a police department audit prior to implementing any program that brings in more unneeded supplies?
Well, you know, I think it's incumbent on the voter to get as much information as possible. Hmm. And like I said, we don't have that information. We need to look at the whole big picture. What do we need to spend? What are we spending on salaries? What's appropriate for a city our size and with our particular needs? One of the things I want to point out about AB 481 was that it was authored by a San Francisco assemblyman with the goal to curb militarized local policing. I think that's real important to remember. It wasn't to celebrate militarizing. It was to control it. They thought, or Chu thought, that law enforcement should be a community partner in public safety, and that police clothing, their gear, and their weapons should meet the standard of a community partner, not a guerrilla warrior, and that communities must have a say in how they are policed, and this gives Chico residents a voice. So we've yet to do that. I think that's one of the most critical things, is that the purpose of this is transparency.
Okay, so if we are not given transparency, what is our recourse? I wanted to ask you this last, but it's such an injustice to the people of Chico for the Chico Police Department to get this policy passed and just bypass the citizenry and go straight to, you know, massive militarization. What can we do?
Oh, it's just so huge. It's I think in this day when we're slammed with so much information, it's hard for us to put our heads together and really look at how we want to spend our taxpayer money and where that money's going. But what we do know is that militarized policing is taking a huge amount of the taxpayer dollar. I think what we have to do is realize that the tools of the military and the tools of good community policing are not the same thing. There are no enemy combatants on our streets. So I think our elected leaders must take a stand against militarization. And that is what AB 481 is attempting to do. But in Chico, it seems that to have led to an opportunity for our police to celebrate their military equipment without even having a public conversation. The program needs to be stopped at the national level and the state level, and we need to establish a whole way of dealing with the public, with even the most troubled, addicted, or violent among us, without first approaching as if we're the military. Our police department functions currently with zero citizen oversight. And I think that needs to change. Concerned Citizens for Justice wants that to change. We need to have policy conversations, and we need our police department to be transparent and accountable to the public they serve. And we need our city council now to stop the acquisition of military equipment, because it is within their power to do that.
Yeah, and, you know, there's so much on this. I know that Biden could put a moratorium on the program. There is legislation in Congress, but unless the Democrats win in the midterms, it will never go anywhere out of the House. It's only co-sponsored by about 16 people. And so in terms of the top-down approach, that right now anyway, this isn't going to help us. What about locally? Who should we be writing to about this?
At the next city council hearing, we ask the public to come forward and speak to this program, to speak out about militarizing our police department. We need everybody to come and do that, and we need people to pay attention to the police department. We need to get more information. You know, CC4J, our goals have been simple. And are simple and fully in line with police reform groups all over the country. This isn't unique to us. Concerned Citizens for Justice is nothing more than a motley crew of wonderful people who are passionate about police reform. And we want de-escalation to become the normal practice. Had our officers used de-escalation with Desmond Phillips, Tyler Rushing, Stephen Vest, those men would have had their day in court, as they were entitled. Our police are not supposed to be judge, jury, and executioner now or ever. So, Concerned Citizens for Justice wants crisis intervention in difficult situations. We want to see an expansion of community-oriented policing, and we want our police demilitarized. And, of course, we want excellent care for our officers following any traumatic incident so that they can return to work healthy and fully functional. And most importantly, I don't think we can control all of this unless we begin to develop a program of oversight of law enforcement on multiple levels. Being involved in establishing the policy for possessing military equipment is just one example of oversight. We need to expand that all the way through. Many cities have a police commission that looks at complaints against the police, examines policy, works with the police to make sure we have the best, they have the best organization they can have responsive to community needs.
Yeah, and so important. I also want to mention to our listeners that Margaret has developed some talking points on Assembly Bill 481 that would apply to the Chico Police Department. Where can we find those, Margaret Zwick?
I think all of it is on our website, Concerned Citizens for Justice in Chico, and contact any of us. And if you'd like to work with us, we'd love to have you there. On May 5th, we're going to host a forum regarding law enforcement issues in Butte County for the Board of Supervisor candidates. So hopefully that will be an excellent conversation because, you know, the sheriff also has to tell the public what military equipment they possess and go before the governing body, the Board of Supervisors, before they get new equipment. I have phone calls into the Sheriff's Department to learn what they're doing with that. I don't know what other agencies in Butte County may be acquiring military equipment. I don't know if the district attorney does. We don't know.
Okay, and I want to let our listeners know also that this is happening all over the country. It's not just in our community. So the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC.org, is doing a webinar on this on the 31st that you can participate in, and they have AB 481 talking points as well. And you can contact the Chico Police Department Professional Standards Unit, which is cpdpsu@chicoca.gov, to register your concerns about this policy if you would like to. Margaret Zwick, we didn't get much chance to talk much about cc4j.org, which is your group, but is there any parting words you want to leave with our listeners about this policy 709 or any other parts of the work that you're doing?
Well, just that it were open, transparent, and anybody who would like to work with us on police reform, we'd love to have you. We have quite a network of Chicoans and people in Butte County who follow our work carefully. But this acquisition of military equipment is not new. The only thing that's new about it is that California law, AB 481, now requires some approval by the city council. And our city council gave approval without having a public conversation. That's the real point.
And
so come out and speak to it at the next city council meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would that be business from the floor or what?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. It's not. As far as I know, it's not on any other way.
Hmm.
And I think what most cities have done is they have had some kind of conversation about it before the city council or the Board of Supervisors took a vote. That didn't happen. And, you know, CC4J pays great attention to what our police department is doing. We missed that this was on the agenda. We just missed it. And thank you to you, Chris, for getting it out to us right away, what's going on. We knew about AB 481, and so it's just fascinating that our police department would consider putting something on their website under the regulatory conditions as being noticed to the public.
Yeah.
I'm sad about that.
Yeah, sad and angry. Well, thank you, Margaret Zwick, for your work with Concerned Citizens for Justice and for being with us today on the Peace and Justice program. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Also, Margaret mentioned that it's the fifth anniversary of the slaying of Desmond Phillips by the Chico Police Department. The Phillips family had a letter at the recent rally. They are asking that
that the office in Sacramento Police Department launches investigations to excessive use of force and battery on Desmond Phillips in 2016, which is part of what led to his extreme PTSD that resulted in his mental health disorder. And then he was murdered the next year in Chico, and they are asking for an investigation of everyone involved in that officer slaying of Desmond Phillips in his own home. And lastly, they are asking for further investigation into fatal shootings in Butte County and investigating the district attorney himself and his office. This is their asking of Governor Gavin Newsom. So if we could take it to the top, we might as well. And then also Scott Rushing, who is the father of Tyler Rushing, has won in court to be able to have a trial, and the city of Chico has appealed to the Supreme Court of the country. There's very little chance that will be heard, but there's a good article about this issue in Chico Soul, S-O-L, Chico Soul. .org if you want to read more about this. And Scott Rushing says, the general mood of the people in America, with the exception of Butte County, Chico, it appears, is to humanize, not weaponize, law enforcement. So this is not true in our community, and we are all at risk as a result of this policy. And not just of violence, but also of surveillance. The policy really does not protect us from drone surveillance or anything else. So, all right. So we're going to move on to our next and last guest. And I really want to thank the work of both Justice for Desmond and Scott Rushing and CC4J, Concerned Citizens for Justice, for all they have tried to do in these last years. I think it's been a noble effort. It's just really unfortunate that our city council is not, and our police department are just going around the citizenry, but that's how it is. And if you're upset about it, I hope you'll step up and make your voices heard, as you will. All right, so we are going to cut to Jose Luis Orozco, who just went off my screen there. Had him. Excuse me. I wiggled the thing. Sometimes it brings it back. All right. Hang on just for a second. My timing is impeccable here. One moment. Okay. Can't get the screens back up. Excuse me while I wiggle the mouse. That's what you're supposed to do anyway. Screens are entirely black. Okay, so I was going to play a song called De Colores. And the reason I was going to play that song is because De Colores was the song of the United Farm Workers and was played at every event that Cesar Chavez led. And we are coming up on the anniversary of Cesar Chavez Day on the 31st. And Cesar Chavez, they don't really talk about him enough. Oh, here he is. Anyway, Cesar Chavez never gets his due, and I'm sorry that today we're not going to give him his due, nor did we give the due to Women's History Month that we should have, but there are great people doing great things in many different areas, and thank you to the farm workers and all essential workers who keep this country running and are so underappreciated. And on Cesar Chavez Day, I always think of the farm workers and everything that Cesar Chavez did in order to ensure the rights of the United Farm Workers and to get people unionized so they had better lives. Here we go. This is Jose Luis Orozco, De Colores.
La canción, una de las canciones más antiguas que conocemos en el idioma español. Se canta en todo el mundo de habla hispana y se canta también ya en todo Estados Unidos. This is a song of the colors, colors of nature, colors of people, the beauty of life, de colores.
De colores,
De colores se visten los campos en la primavera. De colores son los pajaritos que vienen de afuera. De colores son los pajaritos que vienen de afuera. De colores es el arco iris que vemos lucir. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí. Canta el gallo, canta el gallo con el kirikiri, kirikirikiri. La gallina con el cara cara, cara cara cara. Los pollitos con el pío pío, pío pío pí. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí todos. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí.
All right, José Luis Orozco, De Colores. And I have on the line with me Edwin Carmona Cruz. Edwin is the Community Engagement Director at the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice. He leads the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice's statewide campaigns, participatory defense, and rapid response that will help achieve its mission of ending immigration detention in California. Edwin created and co-leads CCIJ's Vaccine Education and Empowerment in Detention program that connects medical professionals to individuals detained in immigrant detention centers and provides culturally and linguistically competent information regarding the vaccine against COVID-19. Edwin also is a member of the Yuba Liberation Coalition, which aims to terminate the Yuba ICE contract. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Program, Edwin Carmona Cruz. Thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I'm so happy to be here. And happy Friday, by the way.
Yeah, really. So, you know, I was lucky enough to be at the rally the other day, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I also want to be able to have you talk a little bit about your organization, California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice, first.
Yes, absolutely. And again, thank you so much for having me. So the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice, or as we call it, CCIJ, is committed to the liberation of immigrants in detention in California by using advocacy, coordination, and legal services. So our work moves beyond traditional legal services, and we support innovative approaches to liberation and empowerment of those individuals detained and their communities. So that's what CCIJ is all about.
And along with that, you know, there's the plight of immigrants now is so much on the back burner, but people continue to be at the border, crossing the border, being detained by ICE, Immigration and Custom Enforcement, and the Biden administration, I don't know what they've done or not done, but can you just give us a quick update about the Biden administration and any progress or lack of progress in terms of justice for immigrants?
Yes, and just before that, I did fail to include also that, as you mentioned in my bio, that CCIJ is also a member of the Yuba Liberation Coalition, which is, again, the action that you mentioned that took place on Tuesday. And this coalition is involved in terminating the Yuba ICE contract and the liberation of the three individuals that are currently detained there. So I wanted just to mention that because the Yuba Liberation Coalition is a very new and innovative group that has evolved over the last year and a half. So I just wanted to mention that briefly, but to your question about what the Biden administration is or isn't doing with respect to immigrants and immigrant justice, it's very simple, Chris. The Biden administration has not delivered on its campaign promises. as we've mentioned and as we've seen, we're seeing more and more detention and more terrifying expansion of surveillance through the Alternatives to Detention program that throughout this administration. And, you know, I think it's important to note that the Biden administration actually inherited a detention apparatus at its lowest point. So we saw, because of the pandemic and because of the work of organizers and advocates across the country, you know, these numbers of individuals in immigration detention were at its lowest peak. But we've seen, even over the last year, such an increase of individuals in immigration detention. While the administration had promised that it was going to bring those detention numbers lower, we're also seeing, as you mentioned, the continuation of Title 42 enforcement, which effectively shuts down the border to asylum seekers. And right now, there's an exception to Ukrainians, which again shows that Title 42 was actually never about public health, right? It was always about excluding certain groups from availing themselves of asylum, which is an international legal right.
Yeah.
And so we have to question ourselves, where is this just and humane immigration system that was promised to us, right? We're also seeing a consistent track of deportation flights of Haitians, even after, I don't know if you've seen, Chris, that viral photo of Customs and Border Patrol whipping Black migrants under that bridge in Del Rio, Texas,
right? Yeah.
So, you know, it's really unfortunate because Democrats have not delivered a just immigration package. And this administration has, you know, the authority to take matters into their own hands. The Democrats do control, you know, the three branches of government, you can argue, or two and a half, I should say. And but, you know, we can only see a just immigration package, justice for immigrants, if this administration, if this party chooses to wield their political capital, which at this point, a year into this administration, I don't see it happening.
I don't either. And I can hear the reverberations of us taking in 100,000 Ukrainians when we've denied every kind of person with all kinds of intense refugee status issues for all this time. It's really upsetting. But and also the Afghani refugees. But, you know, Edwin, I want to say that ICE, on their website, they talk about how they represent virtually, their custody represents virtually every country in the world, all kinds of security classifications, medical conditions ranging from healthy to terminally ill. And they maintain this immigration detention system throughout the country. I would like you to talk about your key human rights violations that have been intrinsic in this taxpayer subsidized program.
Yeah. But I do want to just quickly note that, you know, we welcome any type of asylee refugee, including Ukrainians, right? But it's also just the unjust application of this exclusion across certain groups, and even so I think it's really important to mention that. So
yeah,
just so there's no confusion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Chris, to your point, it's very simple. Detention is not necessary at all. And when you revolve around a profit-based business model around an unnecessary, inhumane detention system, you're bound to have human rights violations. And this is across the board, right? It's also important to mention that ICE has the discretion to release anyone at any time. So the fact that ICE is deliberately choosing to detain immigrants, it means that they're intentionally violating human rights. And, you know, and there's a broad range of those types of human rights violations. And it's very clear to say that these facilities are tainted from the root. Right. Immigration detention expanded right after 9/11. It's rooted in racism. And therefore, there is a dehumanizing process to it.
And also this ICE website says that they are committed to safe, secure, and humane environments under appropriate conditions of confinement. And from your experience as an advocate, and you just touched on that, what what are immigrant detainees and their families going through in response to that statement that these facilities are safe, secure, and humane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like I said, these facilities are tainted from the root, and there is a long history of medical neglect, right? We saw in the South last year or 2 years ago, at this point, the forced hysterectomies, right, on women down in the South at the Irwin County Detention Facility. We've seen the filthy living conditions. We've seen contaminated food and water, exposure to deadly chemicals, violations of First Amendment rights, humiliation, and releasing of individuals just before they die, okay? Just before they die. They're on their deathbed at this point, and they release them to a hospital just so ICE does not have to report it as an in-custody death. You know, there and so those are like the conditions that we see across the board at any type of detention facility, jail, prison in the nation, right? And so, Chris, it's also really important to note that there's, aside from these bigger patterns, there are also this culmination of unbearable situations. They're like these situations that happen day in and day out that cause extreme distress to individuals in their custody. And it is made by design, right? And some of those examples are, you know, some of the people inside these facilities will not receive sweaters until November. So even if there's those couple of cold days throughout the year, you know, they're forced to wear a regular shirt and not a sweater. So they're not fully equipped. And that plays tricks on your mind. Also giving consistently unhealthy food that lacks nutrition over long periods of time messes with your mental health. It messes with your physical health. And that has a lot of other negative impacts, right? So, as a reminder, most of immigrants in detention, especially in California, 99%, everyone except for three people in California, is detained in a for-profit private corporation that holds this government contract, right? These are taxpayer dollars that go to the federal government. The federal government then contracts this out to private prison corporations, right? That they're concerned, their main concern is maximizing their profits. So, of course, when you have this business model, you want to spend little to no money to take care of those in their custody. So all of this happens by design. This is no accident. And this is why I say that these facilities are tainted from the root.
I thought the private corporations were no longer able to do the immigrant detention. So is that not true? Or
I'm not sure if you're referring to the comment or the announcement from the Biden administration. I think it was last year through an executive order, quote unquote, phasing out, you know, private prisons. Is that mm-hmm. what you're mentioning?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, that only applies to Department of Justice facilities, and these are under the Department of Homeland Security. So it was total facade, smokescreen, like this was just media, like a headline for this administration. And in fact, we've seen an expansion through the pandemic of the use of private prison corporations in California. Two facilities opened throughout the pandemic. The Golden State Annex, that is 20 miles north of Bakersfield from another facility, the Mesa Verde, the detention facility, and the Desert View Annex, which is the addition to the Adelanto detention facility up in the high desert of region of California, which is one of, which again, all deadly. Adelanto holds the most individuals and is one of the most deadliest that we've seen across the country. So the administration is very clearly still using private prisons to hold immigrants in their custody.
Okay, well, that is not good news to me. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. But
no, it was.
Mm. You know, I used to visit immigrant detainees held at the Yuba Jail, so I'm aware of the dirty, depressing, inhumane mm-hmm. conditions at that county jail. And mm-hmm. all of us who were advocates were rejoicing last, I think it was October, when the last prisoner was let out of Yuba Jail. Mm-hmm. Not let out, but no longer. The jail was basically closed until December. Now, the Yuba Board of Supervisors has signed a new contract with ICE. Can you describe that contract and what the concerns are?
Yeah, so a couple of things I mentioned, and this is why I wanted to mention our membership, CCIJ's membership to the Yuba Liberation Coalition. And this coalition is the evolution of the first iteration of the campaign called the Free the Yuba 11. And it was because of this community legal partnership that we've seen the people in detention at that time, 2 years ago, at its lowest numbers ever, right? And so we took on this campaign in March, April of last year, and you know, we were able to safely release some of those individuals. Others did end up signing their deportation or were ordered deported. But as you mentioned, you know, in October of 2021, the last person, Ricardo Vasquez Cruz, was released from the Yuba County Jail from ICE custody. And this is the first time that we've seen this facility be completely decarcerated, completely depopulated. And so a couple of things that are important to mention here is that the Yuba Liberation Coalition's mission is to terminate this Yuba ICE contract, which is some important points to note is that this is the last public contract in California. Six out of the seven facilities in California that hold immigrants are privately owned and operated. Yuba County Jail holds this last contract directly with ICE. Again, the last one. And currently, you've heard about the inhumane detention conditions. You've heard about the violations. So ICE is rewarding that type of inhumane behavior, this inappropriate behavior, to the Yuba County Sheriff's Department, a minimum of $8.6 million a year to lease up 150 beds to hold immigrants. And now this contract was amended not that long ago, and its expiration extends indefinitely. So right now the contract expires allegedly in 2099, the year 2099, outliving a lot of us that are listening or and other folks that are in their custody, and it is intended to go on indefinitely. So those are some of the key contract details that the Yuba County Board of Supervisors has with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I don't know if you have any questions or any follow-up on that.
Well, I just wanted to say that I was really impressed with the rally on Tuesday, the enthusiasm and the anger and the honesty of the participants. And I was wondering if you can describe who attended and what their demands were.
Yeah, and if Chris, it's important to note that actually, you know, this rally was in response to comments made by Mr. Randy Fletcher, the board president of the Yuba County Board of Supervisors. We were summoned there. We were forced to go there to take testimonies from directly impacted people, to go outside of the Yuba County Government Center and to share their story and to say, actually, Mr. Fletcher, with all due respect, you know, I was impacted. I was humiliated. I was put in these awful conditions, like you mentioned, as a visitor at the Yuba County jail. And so, yes, there was anger, there was frustration, but there's also a lot of hope, a lot of power, empowerment to say we're a community that is no longer afraid to uplift their voice and to share that they want to see a community without cages. They want to see their communities no longer harmed by this detention apparatus, right? And so we're so lucky and we're so fortunate to have been accompanied by the Faithful Friends, as you mentioned, an amazing mutual aid group, a visitation group that provides such critical moral support for folks in detention there at the Yuba County Jail. We're also accompanied by our partners at Pangea Legal Services, the ACLU of Northern California, a community-based group called Papeles para Todos, Documents for Everyone, Amnesty International USA, and of course CCIJ. So we were really excited to be out there. It was a nice warm day, but it was really great to feel the energy and feel the hope to say that, look, we've decarcerated Yuba County Jail once, and we'll do it again, and we'll do it as many times as possible until we see this contract finally terminated.
And on that note, how do we terminate this contract? How what kind of activism can our listeners be involved in so that that we get system change and that people are no longer detained who should not be imprisoned?
Yes. One thing to mention is that 24 members of Congress actually signed a letter directed to the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, urging the termination of the Yuba contract, right? 24 members of Congress of the California delegation, these are all California congressional reps, including Senator Alex Padilla, who signed on to this letter, and also including Representative John Garamendi. So the congressional rep from California that has Yuba County Jail in its district, John Garamendi, is also saying, hey, yeah, we need to terminate this contract once and for all. So a couple things can happen. Here is the contract was entered between two parties, in this case, Yuba County Board of Supervisors through the Yuba County Sheriff's Department and ICE. So the Yuba County Board of Supervisors can, in fact, say, you know what, we no longer want to do business with ICE, and we will shut down this contract in the next 30 to 60 days or up to 90 days. They can actually do that. And so one thing, and this is why we wanted to also show up and show uplift our voices and show our power at in the Yuba County region to let the Board of Supervisors know that this is something that the community wants. And so if you're a constituent of Yuba County, you can write to your Board of Supervisors and urge them to bring this item up for a vote, up for a discussion, and urge that contract termination, right? And you say that you don't want to live in a county that does business with ICE and separates families as an institution that dehumanizes people, right?
Yeah.
So they're able to do that. The Board of Supervisors is able to terminate it on its own. But also ICE can also say, actually, yes, as we heard this morning, the Etowah County Detention Center and three other facilities in the South are going to be shut down, and some of them are going to be phased out. And so we know that there's precedent for that. This, us and community organizers, directly impacted people, families, and constituents, you know, asking and demanding that this contract be terminated is nothing new. This is happening across the country. And in fact, we want to let the Yuba County Board of Supervisors know that we support them in terminating this contract, and we want to work with this county to ensure that there is just closure and the just transition away from the this carceral system. So and we can also encourage individuals to visit our Take Action platform, so they can send this, they can see a draft template of this email and send it to the Board of Supervisors, and that's Take Action Together. So, takeaction.cciJustice.org. Again, that's takeaction.cciJustice.org, where they can find that template.
Oh, good. I was going to ask you that. So I wanted just to go out on an important note here. The celebration of labor and human rights leader Cesar Chavez is on the 31st, and I would like you. I'd like to first thank you for being my guest today, Edwin Carmona Cruz. But what do you think we can do to honor his memory in regards to hardworking immigrant people who are still doing the crucial work of essential workers in America? What would Cesar Chavez have us do?
You know, I think it's important, and also highlighting what we've discussed today, is to organize. I cannot stress that enough. We must continue to organize for better living wages. We must continue to organize for better living conditions. We must continue to organize to free all of the people detained in immigration detention in jails and in prisons, and continue to organize to finally get basic decency and respect for the people that we are, right? And now more than ever, essential workers, immigrants, working class people are being confronted with deadly conditions throughout this pandemic. And so the answer here, again, is to organize and to make sure we uplift our voice.
That's perfect. And, you know, we are out of time, but I just wanted to say, do you feel complete? Is there anything else you want to add?
You know, I just want to continue saying for folks to continue being involved, ask questions, and to feel free to reach out and to learn more about what we're doing out at Marysville, Yuba County, to terminate this contract once and for all, so we're no longer putting our communities in harm's way.
Thank you very much for being my guest, and thank you for the important work of both the Yuba Liberation Coalition, but also the Community Engagement California Collaboration for Immigrant Justice. Thank you, Edwin.
Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Enjoy your day.
Peace Bye-bye. To you. Bye. Okay, so friends, we're going to have Playing Dead coming up here in a minute with Ray Lager. He's going to be bringing you a great show, so you know that's going to happen. I want to thank our underwriters here and then go to the community calendar. I want to urge you for one last thing is that you get hold of whoever you feel comfortable with, the president, your representatives in Congress, letters to the editor, whatever you can do in order to try to instill the need for negotiations in the leadership of this country so that we don't all perish in a nuclear war. I was up in the middle of the night planning my bunker, and that's not how I want to live, is to be up in the middle of the night planning my bunker. So, folks, I love you all. No matter what happens, I've been grateful always to be here at KZFR Community Radio. And I'd like to thank our underwriters who support us and keep us strong. I'd like to thank first the Chico News and Review, your local news, commentary, and entertainment source. The March issue hits the stands on Thursday the 10th with the rebirth of the Environmental Coalition of Butte County, an interview with musician Melissa Etheridge, and more. The Chico News and Review is available at hundreds of locations throughout Butte County and online at chiconewsreview.com. And Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue, and for details, see squaredealmattress.com. Peace to you all. Have a wonderful weekend. Stay strong. I love you. Here we go.
Hey, listeners. It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Butte County Local Food Network is looking for volunteers in the month of March and April to help them with their third annual Garden Blitz in Chico, Paradise, and Oroville. The Butte County Local Food Network is a locally based nonprofit organization with the mission to create a more healthy, just, resilient, regenerative,